All right, welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I was just explaining to you off mic there about the joys of recording podcasts and how when you hit a record button, it means that any like work that was getting done in or around the house will immediately just happen at the same time. Does that happen to you in your experience as a podcaster?
Well, I mean, literally, it's happened just now. I opened my, I opened the window in this room because this room's at the front of the house, so it's even the slightest bit of sun, it turns into a greenhouse. Mm-hmm. So I came in and thought, I'll open the window, and literally, while my hand was on the handle, our rag and bone man started coming around with a trumpet and shouting, and it felt very timely, definitely.
Followed by like a wagon with some plague doctors ringing bells saying, "Bring out your dead," stuff like that.
That's it, and I was worried I was going to have to explain what a rag and bone man is for like 2/3 of the audience, I'm sure.
No, I used to be one. It was my old trade. No, I really appreciate you coming on the show, Chris. I've been listening to your podcast. We're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about how I discovered you, a wee advert for a game that seems to be in the works at the moment or about to be published. But first things first, like it's always nice to just go back and sort of explore someone's origin story in the hobby. So could you talk to us about a young Chris and how this all came to be, you know, how you got into this hobby in the first place?
Yeah, so I think it's probably a similar story for a lot of people, especially in the UK, which was my first exposure to anything related to like war games or even sort of tabletop gaming, I guess, beyond like Monopoly, was it was like show and tell day. And one of the boys from the year above, who obviously seemed very cool and mature to my, I was like 10 years old, 9 years old maybe. And one of the boys in the year above had bought in a load of White Dwarf magazines, a load of miniatures. And it was kind of not like anything I'd really seen before. Like it's easy to just to joke about like sounding like an old man, but it's in a pre-internet age, I would have never sort of seen anything like this before, or knew that these kind of games existed, or even that these kind of like this sort of creative avenue existed, really. So yeah, straight after that, I was kind of hooked in to the Games Workshop treadmill, I guess. So I got my first sort of starter box that year, and just kind of. It took a long time before I realized that there were games other than Games Workshop games, which I guess is their strategy. So it did work on me for a good long time. But then, yeah, so after a long period of playing Games Workshop games, it kind of went into RPGs as I got kind of older, and eventually sort of returning to miniatures during the lockdown. Actually, that was kind of my sort of second reawakening into miniatures, really, when there's nothing else to do. It suddenly means you get reflective on finding things that are good indoor hobbies. And then, yeah, so I've just done a really quick speed run of my life, which is very depressing to get to age 38 from age 10 so quickly.
It sounds like we're about the same age, and I mean, it doesn't, because when you say 38, I could identify my age, so it doesn't sound like, you know, we pretty much are the same age. there's no ambiguity there. But what year was that you were talking about the boy bringing the stuff into school then? Would that have been like 94, 95-ish?
Yeah, I think it was summer 95, I think. It feels very clear in my head, because it was, I remember sort of it being one of the last days of term at school. So before the summer holidays. So I think it's naturally associated in my head with a very sort of happy time. So maybe that's what sort of drew me in. And sort of spending a lot of that summer, you know, like I say, looking over White Dwarf magazines, saving up pocket money to buy like 10 little plastic clan rats and doing a very bad job of painting them. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. The problem with being 10 years old is a Warhammer Fantasy like starter set might as well have been a new car, as far as I'm concerned. So like, this wasn't something I could just buy with my pocket money. It would have taken forever to save. And it would have taken more willpower than I ever had to actually save up that much money to buy a starter box for like £30 or whatever it was back then. So yeah, it was a long wait until Christmas that year. And then Christmas was when I, got onto the Warhammer Fantasy train.
I like the thought that wee boy came in with his stuff and you were saying he seemed very cool and mature. He didn't get like his head kicked in or that when he unveiled his Warhammer collection. Like it was
no,
it was
because
a question
I think
of awe.
I think at the time, he was kind of like, I think, as in my head, because when I was 10 years old, when you're 10 and you're looking at sort of a 12-year-old, that 12-year-old looks like an adult, I think. When you're younger, the next year up, they seem like these giants compared to you. So in my head, he was like the coolest kid, leather jacket, smoking. And I don't think that was the case at all. But yeah, it felt like it was, oh, this is a thing that a certain type of cool kid can do. When in reality, I think they were probably just a bit of a nerd like so many of us that got into it back then. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it felt... I don't remember there being any teasing about it. I think at the time we were just generally quite impressed.
Yeah. Do you remember your first trip to a Games Workshop store? Was there one in your town? Or like, do you remember how sort of that went?
Yeah, so the nearest one... So I grew up in Staffordshire, in a very small town in Staffordshire, sort of about an hour north of Birmingham. And the closest Games Workshop was in Dudley at the time, just outside Birmingham. And again, it felt like an eternity asking my mum and dad if we could go to one of these Games Workshop shops. Because again, I'm not going and getting the train on my own at age 10. And I remember there being like a huge build up to going there and taking a friend with me. And when we got there, it's the classic tale of a very enthusiastic red shirt employee coming over and telling me that today was special because they pushed together all of the tables and they were doing a giant Warhammer Fantasy battle and they were getting like multiple people on each side. So it felt like I'd come on the right day. And I remember him sort of saying, okay, well, you can be in charge of like these two units over here. So you've got like a dragon and some, I think they're like dark elf crossbowmen, I think. And he said, right, well, and we'll come back to you when it's your turn. So I sort of stood there looking at the miniatures, waiting while everyone else did things I don't understand down the table and rolled lots of dice. And then he sort of came back to me and said, right, so you've got your dragon here and you can fly to any of these places on the board. You can fly over to attack this cannon or these knights over here. So I said, well, let's go and attack the cannon. That seems that's high strategic thought for a 10-year-old. So we'll take out the artillery. So flew in front of the cannon, landed and sort of ineffectively blew fire towards the cannon. And anyone who remembers these older editions of Warhammer Fantasy, this was a Hellblaster Volleygun that I put my dragon in front of. And on the other player's turn, there was lots of dice rolling and firing everything out of this cannon, and my dragon was destroyed. And it sounds like this would be a terrible introduction, but the fact that I still remember that story after... you know, coming on for 30 years, it did stick with me, and it kind of proved the point that you can have these kind of exciting moments coming out of these games, even if it all goes wrong.
So you talked about Clan Rats then. So Skaven, they were your sort of first army that you collected. How did that kind of progress?
I think so I remember in that first trip to the Games Workshop, the guy who came over in the red shirt said, so like, right, are you 40k or fantasy? And I sort of said, I don't really know yet, because I've only been reading White Dwarf. This is my first time here. And he said, what's cooler, swords or guns? And
I think I said
swords. And he was like, fantasy. And it felt like I couldn't argue with him. It felt like it was some kind of like this was my destiny now.
Yeah,
because
he'd anointed you there. Yeah.
He said, yeah, that's it. So I kind of shunned 40k for quite a long time. Not strictly because of that, but I was definitely more drawn to the fantasy. And I think obviously I'd seen things like with dwarves and elves and knights before. And like orcs, even if they were a bit different than what I'd seen before, but the Skaven were like something completely new. They felt like, in a weird way, they felt kind of like the underdogs, because it felt like they almost didn't quite fit with the other ones. They seemed like they were this kind of slightly different tone. And also I was sold by the Doom Wheel. The fact that there's like a giant hamster wheel appealed to me when I was 10, and it still appeals to me today. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that army book is one of the first things I bought, and I probably spent more time reading that army book than I ever actually spent playing battles with the Skaven.
So did you sort of build that Skaven army over the next few years then? Did you collect anything else in that time? Did you play any of the other games?
Well, I sort of gradually collected the Skaven armies. Like I say, I had the starter set later on, so we used those armies a bit to play. But the problem with Skaven is if you're just getting started, and certainly back then, it was quite an expensive army to collect because there were the plastic clan rats, which were quite cheap, but everything else was metal, and you needed quite a lot of everything in Skaven because they were also cheap. So it ended up being a weirdly built army that was. Half of it was sort of plastic clan rats in single pose. And then there was just a lot of big stuff because then when it would come to like a birthday or Christmas, I'd say, oh, I'd like a screaming bell or I'd like a doom wheel for my birthday. I'm not going to ask for six blister packs of plague monks and paint all them. It was very much all or nothing. And I enjoy collecting that army, but I feel like I would make a better job of it today with all the variety of plastic that's available. Because of that, at the time we did get kind of drawn into the other games that were around. So like the Warhammer Quests, Necromunda, even Gorkamorka, anything that was smaller and a bit easier to kind of put together and get onto the table. We generally found that fitted into our, even as children who should have lots of spare time, it fitted into our lifestyles a bit more easily. It didn't feel like this great undertaking where we had to ask my mum if we could use the dining table for a few days while we played out a Warhammer Fantasy battle. Warhammer Quest was probably the one that got the most play. There was definitely sort of a summer when we played that sort of, it felt like sort of every day working through a campaign there, and that's always stuck with me.
Before I go on to talk more about like your hobby journey and that, there was a wee point that you brought up that I just wanted to pick on about pre-internet. So when men of our age, that sounds like a funny thing to say, when we talk about getting into the hobby, there's always like unique circumstances that have happened to put us there in that one position, that one day where you encountered something and that leads you off in that whole direction. And there's the argument, I suppose, that it was quite fortunate that that happened because we didn't have the internet then. Whereas if you've got the internet now, you could be immediately exposed to something like that because you're maybe semi-interested in that genre of thing anyway. But on the other hand, like the internet's such a busy place. There's so much things that want your attention. I wonder, like, is it now more or less likely someone will encounter, Games Workshop or the hobby, the wider hobby? Than it was before. Is it necessarily easier now, do you think, for people?
I'm not sure. I think it's probably easier in the sense that if you're a little bit curious, you can just go and, Google it, and you can have all the information that you could ever want, and videos of people playing it and people talking about it. Whereas back then, it did feel like, sorry, I feel like I'm physically aging as we have this conversation because I'm aware of how much of an old man I sound like. But I think back then there was, if you, like I say, you had White Dwarf and you had like your couple of friends in my case who were into it as well, and that was kind of your entire forum for this. So like when the new issue of White Dwarf would come out, it felt like you were getting lots of new ideas, whereas I feel like now you could just jump headlong into this huge online world of people who are incredibly enthusiastic, like far more enthusiastic than you could possibly be about this game. And yeah, it's interesting to think about whether that would have changed things, about whether some of that kind of mystery would have been lost a little bit. But I think you're right that the difference is that people who don't get that kind of fortunate, coincidental moment of somebody introducing them to it, for those people, it's that wouldn't have happened at all. They actually do have a window into it rather than sort of waiting for that chance.
One thing I get nostalgic for is just the depth back then. Like I'm currently rereading all my old White Dwarfs. I just decided to go back through them. So I'm like 94, 95 now, the years, I mean, looking through these old White Dwarfs, and it's amazing how much of that stuff, how much of these articles and little editorials are still burned into my memory because I must have read these magazines. I wouldn't like to say how many times I've went cover to cover on them. Whereas these days, a piece of content, a lot of it's here and gone. Even a physical magazine, I like to get miniature war games magazines because I like having a physical thing to read. But I will, for most parts, just be skimming it a lot Whereas back then, I don't know if it was to do with an age thing as well. You know, you just had this finite amount of stuff to keep you occupied. But I like that thought of, you know, I'm really in depth on this. I'm reading this cover to cover. I pretty much know everything that was in this magazine. And yeah. I don't know if you're the same age these days, because there's just so much. There's the fire hose of content online. Will anyone ever go that in depth now? Possibly, but...
And you would read the articles about games that you kind of, you weren't even playing. Like, I remember when I came in, it was just at the end of Epic, before the Epic 40,000, like, third edition thing came back. It was just as the death knells of the sort of, I guess, like, second edition Epic were going on. So there would just be occasionally be, like, a weird article about this game that none of us were really interested in. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really see very much of in the shops. But I still remember reading them. I can tell you all about, you know, Nurgle Demon Engines and the Slaanesh Knight Titan things. Because yeah, you would read it because the world was engaging enough that the sort of the world of the game was engaging enough that it made me want to read about these things that I really knew I was never going to play in. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, I suppose I would just have gone and absorbed everything from the Skaven section of like a wiki somewhere.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just a different type of engagement, isn't it?
Aye. I mean, I'm kind of romanticising it, but I knew like the Argos catalogue back to front. Like, it was just, like I say, you had so little content, you probably read things. You know, my mum's TV Times magazine, let me have a look at that. What's in the letters page?
Back of the cereal box.
Yeah, exactly. Sitting in the toilet with your toothpaste tube, just reading the ingredients. Sodium lauryl sulfate, always remember that.
We're not painting a very compelling picture for the younger people.
No,
listening.
I know. Weren't the 90s great? you talked about, or you touched on a wee while ago there about sort of coming back into miniatures and that during COVID, like I think a lot of folks did. So how did they, I mean, was it a complete break from the hobby? Were you still doing certain things? Like, how did that all sort of pan out?
So I probably kind of stopped, like, I think the last time I would have bought miniatures was like when I was, I guess like just before I went away to like university, maybe a little bit before then. And I think then partially just money, I guess, is less, you have less expendable income, or rather your expendable income is going other places when you're kind of an older teenager and a young adult. But then, and I was getting more into RPGs then, so I think I was more in that space. But I always like kept a little eye on what was happening just out of interest to see like, oh, what do the miniatures look like these days from like for this game? It was more of just a kind of, I would occasionally look in from the sidelines. And I think around the time, just before kind of COVID and the first lockdown, I think I was feeling like, so at the time I was, you know, designing RPGs and I was playing lots of board games and I was becoming more interested in going back into that miniature gaming space. And it kind of, in an unfortunate way, it presented a real opportunity where it was my birthday not long after the first lockdown started. And someone gave me like a voucher for Amazon, I think it was. And I thought, well, I'm going to buy myself something to actually keep me busy during lockdown. I picked up just a couple of plastic kits. I picked up a kit of Gene Stealer hybrids and a kit of, what's the actual word I'm trying to say? The Skitarii Vanguard, the AdMech guys. And I tried kit bashing because I always loved the idea of converting miniatures. I always used to look at those miniatures in White Dwarf that people had converted. And like, even if it was just a simple like head swap. But whenever I tried to do it back then, it was literally like trying to cut lead with like a little rubbish Stanley knife that I found in my dad's drawer. And I could just never do it. So now that they had all these kits in plastic with multi-parts, I thought I'll just buy them just to do a bit of kit bashing. And I'm not going to bother like playing anything. And then I thought, well, I'll just get some terrain because it'd be nice to have some terrain to just put them on. So they just look nice. And then it sort of deteriorated from there and I fell straight back into the well. And I've still been very sensible in terms of how far I go back in. But the main thing is I've been looking into the wealth of games outside of Games Workshop. And that's been kind of one of the things that's been really excited about coming back into it.
You talked there about your RPG background and writing games and that. So if we go back to, you know, what was the genesis of that?
I think it was around this was when third edition D&D was being like developed. So this was, I think, 2000. It was when I was kind of falling off the back of miniature stuff. I guess I was like 15. So I thought I was too cool for this stuff now. And sorry, it sounds ridiculous to say I was too cool for miniatures, so I went into RPGs.
Yeah.
But I guess it's a different kind of cool.
Yeah.
I remember reading all the... I don't know how I fell into it, but I remember reading some of the like the blogs that the designers of 3rd edition D&D were writing. And I thought, oh, well, it's a new edition of Dungeons & Dragons, which I sort of knew about, but I didn't know anyone who played it. And it was this kind of slightly alien thing off on the sidelines to the games that I had played. So I thought, well, I'll follow this along and I'll go and get the core books for this. So I got the core books for 3rd edition, which they were separated by like a month. So you had to buy the Player's Handbook, wait for a month, then buy the Dungeon Master's Guide, wait for a month, and then the Monster Manual. What felt like a very long wait between them. And that kind of is what got me started. And even though looking back now, there's a lot about that game I don't like. It's very complicated. It's very much, it tries to have like a rule for everything. And even the specifics of how the rules work don't really appeal to me that much now. But what got me excited was very much like absorbing all that stuff from White Dwarf. It felt like there was so much like world here that could be explored. And you didn't need to have like the miniature to do it. So if I wanted to include a huge black dragon in one of my games, I didn't need to go out and buy a £50 miniature from Games Workshop made out of lead and super glue it together and paint it. And that was very appealing at the time, as well as obviously the whole RPG style of play where you're not as bound by the rules. You can choose to do whatever you want to do. But it was the idea of running the games especially that appealed to me, the idea of like creating your own worlds and creating your own like dungeons to be explored and things like that. So that was where I got my start. And then being as thrifty as I am, after that I kind of thought, well, there must be some free games online that you can get. And I really started to dig into like free games that people have made and put up on forums or message boards or websites. And that's where I found sort of the rules light side of things that really started to appeal to me.
So you're playing these games, and then how do you transition to start to making your own or writing your own?
I think it started to be honest. I always use this anecdote, but I think it still stands up, which is that when I was not long after I got into miniatures, someone like an older cousin gave me an old copy of HeroQuest that they had knocking around. And they said, oh, you like this kind of thing. Here you go. I had this when I was younger. I don't want it anymore. And, you know, it was great, but it was missing the rule book. You know, it had the rule book, but it didn't have like the adventure book that actually told you what the scenarios were. So I had this big board and all these pieces, and I knew how you could attack and how you moved and things like that, but I didn't know what you actually did. So me and my friend would just take turns essentially being the dungeon master and just making stuff up as we went around. And I've joked that that's how I sort of started in RPG design, because from then on, it kind of showed me that, yeah, you can just kind of make up your own stuff to go with these games if you don't quite like how it works. But the first kind of serious attempts that I made were around that time when I was discovering that lots of other people were like putting out free games, because I thought, well, if other people are doing this, of course I'll be able to do it straight away. So I'm gonna make something and it's going to be brilliant first time. And I don't think they were brilliant first time. There are lots of sort of failed games I have tucked away in my Google Documents folder. But the process of tinkering around with the rules and stuff was sort of innately fun to me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Our question of the month for April 2024 is, have you ever tried to convince a 40k or Age of Sigmar player to play a non-GW miniatures game? If so, what was the response? What game did you play? And crucially, did they enjoy it? I'd love to hear about your own experiences on this front, and you could record your audio feedback by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now, back to the show. So what were some of the first games that you created and put out there and kind of got a reception for then?
Well, you can probably guess that the first attempt was, I think, the same as everyone, which is Dungeons & Dragons is pretty good, but I reckon I can do it better. So it was a game called, it went through various names. It was called Underworlds and Overworlds at one point, I think. And then I think The Adventurer's Tale was where I kind of left it. And it was a very stripped down, rules light fantasy adventure game. But there was absolutely nothing interesting in there. There was no reason for anyone to be interested in this over any of the other sort of simplified versions of D&D. And then from there, I kind of started to discover more... I sort of discover more styles of RPG that people were making and realize that it didn't have to just be like a D&D knockoff. So I had one that was around like urban exploration. Like, you know, you see these people that go into like abandoned warehouses and stuff.
Mm.
And I made a very, not complex, but I really spent a lot of time working on the system for like, well, how far can you jump and how quickly can you climb? And I had all this ready. And then I sat down and I realized there's no like game here. This is just rolling some dice and saying you go into a room and there's a jump. Are you going to make it? And you roll some dice and you say, no, you didn't make it. And that's one that's always stuck with me, because that kind of really cemented in my head that you can spend all this time on the rules, but the rules aren't the game. Like, mm-hmm. the game is like, well, why am I doing this? And why do the players care? And what does the actual play at the table look like? That's more important to me even than like, well, what dice are we rolling in? What are my percentage chances to succeed?
So talk to us a wee bit about the period, you know, in between this and you actually getting back into the miniature hobby, like when you started to see some sort of success with your rules writing and your games.
Yeah, so between then, actually, the big thing was that I eventually started to get a bit of a handle on making games that actually worked. And the one that I did I started writing it in 2011 and released it in 2014. It was called Into the Odd, which was a very sort of minimalist... It is still drawing on some elements of D&D, but it had a kind of weird industrial horror kind of vibe to it and sort of extremely stripped back rules. And that one was one that people actually seemed to like and people actually seemed interested in. So I then did a follow-up to that called Electric Bastionland, and that was successful enough that I was able to... at the time, my day job was winding up anyway, so I was a bit of a crossroads in terms of employment, and I thought, you know what, this is an opportunity to try, see if I can do this as a career. Mm. So after that book, I've been full-time in game design ever since, and that was 2020, so yeah, just over 3 years now.
Mm. So that we arrive at that point where like you're getting back into miniatures and that, and then... You know, I've recently, like I said earlier, I read the Miniature War Games magazine, so I see an advert for a game, The Doomed, and it looks really interesting. I think I start looking into that. Found out, a podcast there and stuff like that that you're on. So talk to us about this game and you know, its origins and what we can expect from it.
So The Doomed kind of started because of those miniatures that I started kit bashing together, and like I say, I did them from some Warhammer 40k kits, and then I also went and bought like some random bits from like Bitsbox online, and I found some old like kits that I had like lying around from like in my mum and dad's cellar from when I was like a teenager. So I put some of those in there as well, and I was kit bashing all this stuff together. And there are lots of games now that sort of take this miniature agnostic approach where you can kind of bring whatever miniatures you want to the table. But I couldn't like help myself thinking, well, I'll just tinker around and see if I can make something that I can use these miniatures for. So it started off as kind of a very simple, just like we'll do like a warband skirmish thing, sort of inspired by like the Ink 28 stuff, some of those rule sets. And it kind of escalated from there, because then it went from, well, I've got these two warbands, but I've also kitbashed some big horrible monsters and I want to use those. So I had these sort of, initially these monsters were kind of almost like random encounters coming into the battle, kind of similar to you get in like Frostgrave and Stargrave. But then they started to become more and more the focus of the game, to the point where now it's competing warbands sort of hunting down these big horrors. So you're fighting the other warband, but you're also both fighting this big kind of boss monster sort of thing almost.
Mm.
And it might have some minions as well. It all came out of necessity, really, which I think is where a lot of the best ideas come from, because it was based around making something that was an excuse to kitbash more miniatures and an excuse to use the miniatures that I'd already thrown together. So yeah, that's what it ended up being. It ended up being a very, very rules light sort of warband versus monster style game.
What's your kind of ethos with writing a game, you know, and the experience that you want to give to the player? Do you have any sort of concrete thoughts on that? I mean, presumably you do, given that you make them, but just interested to hear them.
Well, like I said, the thing that story about my dragon getting blown up by a cannon when I was 10 years old, like in my very first game, has stuck with me a lot more than perhaps some other battles where it's been sort of, perhaps it's been a very closely knit thing and it's been kind of back and forth and it's kind of been a bit more subtle, if you like. So I think I do lean towards having just enough kind of chaos and drama in there so that it still feels like you've got control over what you're trying to do. But then you'll get these little moments where it's almost like the camera like snaps to slow motion for a minute and zooms in, and you get these moments like where you get like critical hit tables in RPGs sometimes like spiral into this kind of chain reaction of other things. And that's what I wanted to have. I wanted to have a game that ran quickly most of the time, but then it sort of slowed down for these moments that created these kind of storytelling kind of beats almost. And yeah, like I've said with RPGs, that I've always wanted to make games that I only try and make a game if it's something that I actually want. I don't think there's any point trying to make a game for other people. So I didn't want to like identify a gap in the market and say, well, this is what I'm going to go for. It was very much because I wanted a game that really pushed up against the limits of like rules light. So these aren't necessarily all revolutionary things, but like there's no measuring in the game. So you don't need to have any measuring. There's no tracking of ongoing conditions. So if other games, you get things like a model might be like fatigued or poisoned or distracted. There can be all number of these tokens that you put all over the board and like wound counters and stuff like that. I wanted to avoid that. So there's no tracking of individual things. Anything that happens kind of resolves straight away. And then you get back to just being able to focus on the miniatures on the table. And no measuring, no stacking, and no measuring, no tracking, and no stacking is the third one, which is not having lots of plus ones and minus ones that affect the same role. So every type of role in the game can only be affected by one single thing. So if you're shooting someone, if they're in cover, it's minus one, and that's the only thing that will ever affect a shooting role in the game. And it's not, I think it's, this kind of game is not going to be for everyone, but I think for a certain type of person like me, it will kind of feel different, and it will feel like it perhaps does something that weren't able to get elsewhere.
On the sort of topic of lore and story world, like if I think about, you know, a couple of my favourite games, like for example, Song of Blades and Heroes tells you, you know, this is fantasy / medieval, but have at it. You know, we're not going to give you a world, we're not going to give you any of this. Then you look at like Joe McCulloch's games, who you've mentioned already. So Frostgrave gives you the world and the setting, but doesn't micromanage it. And then we go to, you know, something like Warhammer Fantasy. We've got maps, we've got canon, we've got fully developed lore. Where would you say that the Doomed fits into that sort of spectrum?
So this is a term that I've heard. I think this is something that Grant Howitt said, the RPG designer, but I'll give him credit, even if it's not necessarily his words. He said something about enjoying games that had not very much lore, but lots of flavor and lots of tone. So you can, I wanted to create a world where there's no maps or timelines or like specifics, but there's enough kind of like flavorful little bits thrown at you that you kind of get a sense of, oh, this is how this world is. And it sparks enough creativity that you can kind of think, well, you look at the world, you think, well, I'm going to make a warband that kind of looks like this, and this feels like it fits. So like the factions, for instance, are all kind of, the faction descriptions are like maybe two lines of flavor text for each faction and like a little line of flavor text under each of the units. But I wanted to keep them all broad enough so that you could use whatever miniatures you want to kitbash at the table. So like there's mentions of like one of the warband are called Exiles, and it says, well, these are the only like alien faction. These are like exiles from the stars that have ended up on this horrible world. But I didn't want to say, oh, and here are the 12 different types of alien species and here's what they look like. Because if I leave that open, then, you know, you can use like your Predator miniature from the Predator movie game if you want, or you can use just put a Tyranid head on top of a Space Marine body and say that's my alien. You can kind of do whatever you want. And I think that's where I kind of sit on that middle ground, where I like all that flavor and stuff of a game like 40K, where it feels like this world has a very particular tone. But I wanted to keep the openness of something like say Songs of Blade and Heroes, where it's like, use whatever you want. Use whatever fantasy things you have lying around.
What are some of the baddies or monsters that we might find ourselves fighting in this game?
So again, the big sort of horrors that you're facing, I wanted to keep the descriptions broad enough that you could kind of find a way to use whatever monsters or big like units that you had around. So they generally fall into if you're playing a campaign of this game, there's going to be like five dooms. So these are five ways that the campaign will end if you don't achieve your own agenda. So there's like hunger, ruin, domination. I should have got these up before I started saying this. and two more. Oblivion and famine, I want to say. Hunger. There's five of them anyway. And they're kind of like exemplified in the horrors. So the first one that you have is just called the Devourer. And it has like, if you look at its stat line, it's got big claws and it can spit digestive acid at you. And when I made this horror, I made like a kind of a bug-like kind of creature with like this big like fly like style mouth, and that's kind of how I'd pictured it in my head. But then for the miniature photography in the book, we got Anna Polanchak of Gardens of Hecate, and she did a her version of the Devourer was like this like three-headed wolf, like big like muscular creature, and it looked completely different to mine, but they both fit into this theme of the Devourer. And so the horrors each have enough flavor, hopefully, to get you inspired to model something. And in terms of their rules, they all break the rules in one way or another. And I wanted them to feel almost like when you fight a boss monster in a video game, I guess, where you part of it is just fighting it, but part of it is also working out how it works and working out, is there something I need to do specifically to take this on? So yeah, that they've been fun to work on. And there's 36 of those in the book, so plenty to go with.
Plenty of baddies to fit. The Devourer presumably is the hungriest one.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
So what about the playing size that we might optimally want to use, the dice type and the time it would take us to play a game?
So your warbands are, it's kind of designed for 28mm, but to be honest, because there's no measuring, as long as you're using like the same scale, you could do it with whatever you wanted to do, really, as long as they're individually based. But if you're playing with that 28mm, I've been playing on either 2x2 or 3x3 foot tables. So I wanted it to be something you could just throw out onto a kind of ordinary size table quite easily. You do probably want to have quite a lot of terrain. Because there's no measuring, positioning is much more important than like distance. So it's not so much of a factor of how far away is that unit across open ground. It's more what's the route look like to get there, because movement is restricted by like obstacles and cover. So it's more about getting lines of sight and sort of being in a strong position than it is about distances. But the warbands themselves, when they start out, it's probably going to be four or five models, maybe six if you go a certain way. So you could very easily get started on this with, you know, four or five miniatures each, and a big nasty thing to go in the middle.
Mm. And how long will that take us, and what are we actually rolling?
So, D6s all the way. It's all D6s. And in terms of time, this is the one that I've never quite, it does vary. You can get through some games pretty quickly. I would say at an absolute maximum, you're going to be done within an hour, I would say, quite easily. But when I've been playing it with someone who's already played it, you can quickly get through something even in like half an hour, 45 minutes quite easily.
Mm, cool. I'm really looking forward to checking that out. Like I say, it caught my eye in the magazine. So it's through Osprey. Am I right in saying that?
That's right, yeah, Osprey. So it's with them now. The game is all finished. I think the last I heard, August was the date.
Yeah,
I've not heard any changes. So it's just it's just the waiting game now, which is painful for me, because it feels like this has been kind of a long time coming for me. Like I say, it was, well, I mean, I guess 3 years ago was when I kind of started working on it, so that's quite a quick turnaround for a game to come from scratch. But yeah, it feels like I know a few people who are keen to get it, so I'm really looking forward to the release.
What do you do with a release? Like, what happens? Do you go on some podcast, do some videos? Your own podcast, last I checked, you've not had an episode out on that for a while. Will you get that back on the road for a wee bit?
Or? Yeah, so the thing is, some of the games that I make, I publish myself, and some of them I've done through other publishers just for whatever's the best fit for that particular game. This is an interesting one because it was my first kind of foray into miniature war games. I thought I want to do this with somebody who knows what they're doing, basically, and who people will perhaps recognize. So that's how I kind of ended up with Osprey. And yeah, the interesting thing about this is a lot of the release, a lot of the work now is being done by them, which is great for me. But yeah, like you said, the main thing for me is to be speaking to people who want to talk about it. And there's been a few articles, like they say, there's the one in War Games Illustrated this month. That I've written for them. In terms of the podcast, that's always been kind of like a little bit of a sideline for me. I do like video streams as well, so I've been doing those a bit more lately instead. But I do try and keep writing games as my main thing. I'm not looking to make all of the YouTube and podcast stuff is definitely a sideline for me. So I kind of do them when I feel like I've got something interesting to do, rather than, I feel like if I said I'd do one every week, they'd end up pretty dire pretty quickly.
I mean, the podcast sounds really good. Like, is that something that you'd done before? Like, when did you actually launch that show?
I think I did the first series of the podcast. I think that may have been during the lockdown as well. Again, just looking for anything to do. No. I think it was just before, because it was around the release of Electric Bastionland, which was 2019. That was when that Kickstarter happened. So I think it was the original podcast there was a stretch goal for that Kickstarter, now I remember. So yeah, it's been going for about 3 years, but I do 6 episode series, and I'm following the TV model, well, at least the UK TV model, of maybe not doing as many series. I'd rather do a few series and keep them limited, but make them all good, like you say, rather than have like hundreds of episodes and I'm not especially proud of some of them. So it's definitely something I want to go back to, but I'd like to have something new to talk about on there, and something a bit different to do.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're really professional sounding on the show, like, and there's a good audio quality. So I was really impressed. You know, I do hear a lot of podcasts where the content can be good, but you know, sometimes maybe their audio quality will let them down, or there's other wee issues going on, but the show seems to be really polished. I wondered if maybe that was something that you had a background in as well.
Well, I was going to say no, but when I went to university, I did music technology. So I learned all that stuff and then promptly forgot it all when I went into a completely different area of work.
Yeah.
But no, I guess I at least know how far to put my head away from a microphone. But no, I think that the thing is, I think going up even a small bit from like a free microphone that comes with a computer makes a huge difference. So I don't have any especially fancy gear here, but I think just little things like that make a big difference, because yeah, like you say, there's some podcasts that I love, but I listen to them in spite of the quality So yeah, I was keen to avoid that.
Do you, I know you say you were earning on the side of streaming and video and stuff like that recently, but, you know, do you see podcasting as quite an important thing in the hobby? It obviously had a big boost during the pandemic, which a lot of other mediums did as well, a lot of online mediums. But, you know, how do you sort of think of podcasting in relation to this hobby?
Well, weirdly, because I used to listen to podcasts every day on my commute to work. But during the lockdown, obviously, at the time that was actually the first week of lockdown was the first week I went self-employed writing RPGs. So I went from commuting to work every day and listening to podcasts to working from home. So if anything, my podcast listening has just like plummeted during lockdown and after that. But I think I think they it's important to have all that variety, because I know some people really like the video content and that's how they absorb a lot of this stuff. I personally sort of have a real soft spot for like blogs and like longer form stuff, and some of the stuff that's going like in newsletters, in like Substack newsletters and stuff nowadays. But having it spread between those things, or having like videos, blogs and podcasts all kind of presenting the view in a slightly different way, I think it's really important to have kind of all three options, because then people will kind of find the one that's the best fit for them, is my view anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we did an episode just recently about, part of it was about podcasting, and just, you know, the benefits of creating on, and whether it's a good thing for somebody, or, you know, whether they want to do a bit of social media or YouTube or whatever. Because I think creating content around your hobby, no matter what you're doing, there's a lot of benefits of it, you know, the community, the accountability and stuff like that. And obviously you'll see folk doing really well on, for example, something like Instagram. But I think podcasting's massive, or one of the massive advantages over that, is the fact that, like, you own the access to your audience with a podcast or with a blog, you know, with a peerless website. Whereas if you're on a third-party social media site, that could all just disappear tomorrow if the company who owns it decide to pull the plug. It's unlikely YouTube will go away tomorrow, but your audience is still kind of owned, or your access to your audience is still kind of owned by that other company.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when there's been, well, I feel like there's been a constant crisis over like Twitter from like the day it was born. But I think like, especially lately, I've seen a lot of people talk about moving away from it, and they almost like feel like they're stuck, and they feel like they can't leave this platform, even though they don't like what it represents anymore, or even just like how it works with its algorithm and things like that. And so yeah, that I'm always very cautious about placing any sort of getting too invested on anything like that that's owned by an external agency. I think mailing lists are fantastic for that reason, because email is pretty safe to say email is not going anywhere. People change their emails more rarely than they move house, is it the fact that I've heard recently. So I think if you can get people's emails, you've got kind of a nice regular way of contacting them. So interestingly, I've seen since I started my email newsletter with Substack, I've noticed that that has been sort of growing more quickly than the blog, and more quickly than YouTube, more quickly than the podcast. So I think there's definitely something in that at the minute. But the problem is these things always change, isn't it? So by the time this podcast comes out, that's probably going to be not useful knowledge.
No, not at all. Not at all. I always like kind of geeking out on these things, and you know, it's a topic that interests me a lot. So speaking of like the email list and that, for the listener who wants to keep up with you to see what games you've created already, and of course to get the Doomed when it comes out as well, where can they go to subscribe to your mailing list, to find your podcast and any other information?
Yeah, so if you go to bastianland.com, all of that stuff is in the sidebar. So there is a Patreon, there is a newsletter with Substack, there is a Discord server, there is a Twitter account, but don't use that because I don't really use that anymore. There is a YouTube channel, there is a Twitch stream, and there is a podcast. So something for everybody, but it's all at bastianland.com.